listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org, also available on iTunes. And g'day wherever you may be around the world. And thank you for joining us once again on the Jono and Shlomo show. Like that?
The Jono and what show?
The Jono and Shlomo. That's what you'd be if you're here in Australia. You'd be Shlomo.
No, Shlomo is my father.
No, it doesn't matter. Just because there's a Shlomo in your name, you're down at the pub, you'd be Shlomo. G'day, Shlomo. No, how you going, mate?
It'll be Joe and Yo, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Not in Australia, he'd be Shlomo.
Nah.
It's time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. How are you, my friend?
I'm finally settling in.
You're settling into your new house in the desert. Yep.
Yeah.
In the nomad in the
desert.
You know
who used to live in desert on the border of the desert?
Who did?
Joab.
Ah, there you go.
If I remember correctly, his house was near the desert.
Okay.
Yep, I'm living the Joab life.
Nice. All right, hang on. Yoel, Keith's talking to me. Hang on a second. He was asking for me earlier on. You're on Truth To You Radio, Keith, with Yoel Ben Shlomo and Jono. How are you, mate?
Oh, I've been waiting for this my entire life. Is Yoel really on the radio?
Yes, I'm actually here. And we just started our recording. What are you doing?
This is awesome. I mean, Jono, just so you know, no one knows this. I told Yoel about 3 weeks ago. I said, Yoel, we're thinking about being in Israel. Can you join us?
Did you see what I wrote to you? Wait. Did you see what I wrote to you? I said, can I join?
Oh, you mean you actually said, well, that would be a shift. If you say that, it's over. You're in. Can I announce it?
Of course he's in. Announce it now, Keith, because we're recording.
Oh, well, listen, ladies and gentlemen, we have just found out that Yoel is going to join Jono and myself as we spy out the land, and this is going to be an amazing experience. People are already responding, and if we have the great Yoel with us, it's going to change the game. So I am extremely excited to announce, and I'm going to actually announce this today, that Yoel has agreed to be a part of the tour. He will never say this, but it was last year. Well, it was actually a year and a half now. I told Yoel that he needs to find a way to start sharing what he's learned, because he sat and spent time with me. And when he started opening up different sources and his history and language, I just said, there's no way we can let this guy be over there in Israel and not share this wealth of knowledge with the world. So I'm excited that he really is doing radio with you. It's pretty amazing.
It's an awesome thing, and the listeners are always telling me that it's thank you so much for Yoel, and that he's a blessing, and that the fountain of knowledge and information, particularly in regards to the Hebrew language, they really do appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, you guys, I didn't know you were on the radio, so I'll wait until you're done. But
that's okay.
But we've done it. We actually have you on Light of the Prophets.
Yeah, now we've got you on Light of the Prophets.
This works. I like the idea. I mean, we just had a guest on the program.
Awesome. You guys should have guests on the program. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm excited. I really am excited the things that you're doing, Jono, by bringing different people in and getting different perspectives. And whenever it has to do with the Word of God, my heart beats a little bit faster. So
it's always entirely my pleasure and privilege to have you guys on the program, and I know the listeners really do appreciate it. And today we're still continuing through Judges, Keith. We're continuing on from chapter 7. We're going to get into that just a little bit.
Oh my goodness, you guys are talking about Gideon, so that's awesome. Well, let me just say this, anyone that's listening, and now that Jono has found a way to get Yoel to say that he's going to join us, I want to announce this to the world that we now have another important piece to the puzzle as we go over to the land and spy out the land. And I'll tell you something, Yoel was one of the key people in the Time Will Tell project, and he brought me into situations, Jono, which people are going to see this when this comes out, that were really amazing, amazing things that he and I did together. So he's a major part of the Time Will Tell project that will be
Yoel has been telling me about some of the things that you've done. You're telling me about some of the things that you've done. I've only seen a tiny little bit of what you've done, and I'm really starting to feel like
I've seen nothing.
I've seen nothing. What did you see?
Hang on, isn't the proclamation on the Temple Mount
I guess if you want to say that, I guess that's the only part. But I will say this. Let me just say this. I'm within a couple of weeks of getting that.
I wasn't part of that. He didn't. Keith did not. You did not involve me in that one.
No. I didn't want to put him in.
You woke up to me and say, "Oh, by the way," he woke up to me and say, "By the way, I was in the Temple Mount. I proclaimed God's name." And I was like, "You actually got away with it."
And you weren't arrested.
Hey, Jono, let me say this. I've said this before, and Yoel, it would be awesome if you'd be willing to do this. When we do actually get this ball rolling, the reason that the delay really has to do with post production. It's really quite a deal, and I'll be able to announce some things pretty soon. But when the ball does get rolling, I would love if you and I do a segment on the Time Without Project. When it comes to what I call the Jewish section, the Jewish aspect of time, Yoel was my guide and my host, and he's the one who really opened up some doors that were amazing. So I would love to have him come in for that section. Maybe some other people come for different sections, but where we could really talk about this, it really is going to bless people deeply.
I am looking forward to it. I am on the edge of my seat, and I know a lot of the listeners are waiting until it is available for them to see. And we're going to be talking about it as soon as it is available. I can't wait.
Yeah. Well, you guys are awesome for having me on. I can't believe it. I've actually been a host, and you let me talk. It's amazing.
Yeah. Now I've noticed that Yoel is letting you talk. How about that?
No, I can't believe it. I'm not used to this.
You're not being interrupted, Keith.
Hey, listen, it's a bit different. You have to remember, Keith is older than me, and he's a very good friend. And you know, you both of you are older than me, so I'm just going to sit quiet for a moment.
Listen, I want to say something, you two. Once you get all done with your program, one of you, either you give me a ring, I'd love to give you updates on some things. Okay.
Excellent.
Okay.
Blessings to you two.
Good on you, mate.
You too. Thanks. Good to hear you.
All right, my friend. Bye bye.
Cheerio.
Okay. Well, bye.
Brilliant. There goes Keith.
Yeah, that was good.
He's a guest on our program now. We can say he's a guest on Light of the Prophets. There he goes.
Yeah, we had a guest.
So you're going to be on the tour. There's just to fill everybody in, ladies and gentlemen, there is a tour in Israel. It will be in March from the 3rd to the 13th. Anyone who would like to be involved, I'll be there. Keith will be running it. Yoel will be there. Going to be making guest appearances as well. And we're going to be spying out the land, as Keith puts it. And so if you are interested, and there's only limited space, so if you are interested, what you need to do is go to www.hishallowedname.com, click on the contacts page, and you can inquire there and send that through. And you'll get an email. So if you do that, www.hishallowedname.com, click on contact, inquire there, send it through, and you should get an email concerning the details. So there we go. Now, Yoel,
yep.
Back to business, my friend. We're in Judges chapter 7. Now, look, I don't know if we can. Hang on. We were talking about you living in the desert before we were getting here.
Yeah. So. We just moved. This is why we're kind of behind. This is why I wasn't actually on Facebook that much. The fact remains that to have internet, you know, I don't even have a phone line. We ran out of phone numbers in the area, so I actually am using only my cell phone. And I actually had to go buy a net stick to have internet, so I can actually do the recordings and keep on teaching.
Now
it's working. It's working very nicely. So it's nice. Thank God.
That's good. And if the listeners listen in the background, the place is still being built. You can hear a drill or a hammer every now and then.
Yeah, the building we're living in, it's a two story house. We live on the top story, and the landlord lives on the bottom story. We actually moved in before the landlord, so nice. we're living. It's kind of an issue because we're living kind of like in an industrial area, like basically a construction site. So it's like there's less area the kids can play at until they start clearing off all the rubble and all the rubbish around here, which is going to be in the next month, hopefully. But it's pretty amazing what a desert does to you. I'm actually able to study more in less time.
Really? And, how so? Because it's quieter? Yeah. You're less interrupted?
It's
what do you
quiet.
Mean?
Yeah. This is what happens when you live in a very quiet area, and this place is like dead silent most of the time. And what happens is that your brain's not preoccupied with the noises around. Mm-hmm. So more parts of your brain can be occupied with what you're doing at the given moment. So time also flows a bit differently here. It actually moves a bit faster. I don't know. I just noticed that time's going a lot faster when we're here.
Probably because there's less distraction. Let me ask you a question. At night, I mean, you're a little bit southeast of Jerusalem, right? How Yeah. Is it darker? I mean, are the stars brighter? Do you see more of the stars?
Yeah, you can actually see a lot more stars. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. What we do is we switch off all the lights. Yeah. And we go to, we have like a small balcony, which is really where the stairway is and leading to the house. But when we share it with someone else, there's two apartments here and then there's a house underneath. Uh-huh. But you can either walk away from the house slightly outwards a bit more. Walk like, I don't know, 100 yards outside and you can pitch black. And you look up and suddenly more stars than you see in the city. So, yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful. It must be beautiful to look at the stars over the desert.
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing. You sit there and you look into the distance, you know, for example, sunset. At sunset, the mountains, there's different type of light during sunset. So the mountains, you see the curves clearly, and it's just amazing.
Beautiful. Well, I tell you what, we better jump into it. And the reason is because I want to see, Yoel, if we can get through chapter 7 and the majority of chapter 8 up to verse 29. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it, but I'm going to give it a shot. What do you reckon?
So I'll just cut back a bit, I think.
Okay, let's see what we can do. Because we're in the middle of Gideon and we're in chapter 7 of Judges, and it begins like this. Now, Yerubbaal. Now, that's.
Yerubbaal.
Yerubbaal, thank you. That is Gideon.
It's like when I was recording with Keith, you know, the English says, for example, we're talking about Yerubbaal, and in English it says he's called Jeroboam, but that's an extra sound. So I kept on saying Jeroboam because Jeroboam is closer to what it actually sounds in Hebrew, Yerubbaal. So I'm looking at these names and looking at the English, and it's like, the English and the Hebrew are so different because they had to add sounds to be able to pronounce certain things in English. So I'm not surprised you're having trouble with some names here and there.
Well, I've got Jeroboam. Just remind everybody what that means again.
So originally the name Yerubbaal is Yerubbaal. So it was actually a name which was used in a positive way. I didn't say this last time. It was actually used in a positive way. As you know, from the word, the idea of the Baal would increase or whatever it is. But here it's used in a different way. So it's probably a real name. One of the things I saw was that it was probably a real name. And here it was used differently from what it actually originally meant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I mentioned also, is the name Gideon, the name Yerubbaal, these are all names that have a meaning. What it could be that Gideon's name and it wasn't his real name. Because Gideon is from the root of Gadal, which means to cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And the on at the end is a sentence considered to be an adverbal ending. So it's very confusing. I mean, I'm not 100% clear always about these different endings you have on names. But one of the things it looks like, it gives it an adverbal meaning, which means Gideon actually meant the one who cuts off, which also fits the idea of the one who cut off the enemies.
Yes.
So there's a question, is this his real name? This came up in a discussion with a student about last week or something like that. And I went through several books and they mentioned this this suffix. I mean, I won't be surprised if Nehemiah can pull out something a bit more clear.
Possibly. But there's a number of names that are interesting in this passage. We will get to them. But in any case, in the very first verse, both names, the one that was given to him because he cut down the Asherah poles and destroyed the altar of Baal, he was given that name, and of course Gideon. And all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Harod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill in Moreh in the valley. And Yehovah said to Gideon, here it begins, the people who are with you are too many for me.
There's a game here because we mentioned that there's a factor of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gathering this huge army, and God's like, no, I don't want that. I want you to reduce the number of people. He will probably standing there going like, what do you mean? He says, yeah, you're going to be cutting down the amount of people that you're going to be sending with you as an army.
And goes on to say why.
He was scared.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And we touch on that a little later as well. That comes up again. But the Midianites, it says, you got too many people. You got too many people for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claimed glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. That's the reason why he wanted to cut it down. That's the reason why he wanted to trim them out, is because he didn't want them to be able to say, hey, you did this, we did this, we're good, we did it without the help of God. We deserve the glory for this victory. So he said, trim them down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the way, 8 chapter 22, and I'm jumping right ahead to almost to the end of where we are, but I just wanted to highlight, mm-hmm. it says in 8 chapter 22, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, yeah. this is verse 23, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. Yehovah shall rule over you. So it kind of happened anyway, but I guess we'll get there.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you don't necessarily have to link it to this. You have to remember that the motif inside the stories of the Book of Judges is that there's no leadership. Mm-hmm. And now there's this guy from the house of Joseph, mm-hmm. which were considered to be one of the most important families. First, he came from a very important family. We pointed that out at one point. And also, the fact remains that he comes from the house of Joseph, which was considered to be the firstborn. As you remember, Jacob took away the rights of the firstborn from Reuben and mm-hmm. Reuven and gave it to Joseph, to Yosef. Yes. And so the family of Yosef is the most important family. You know, and a lot of the leadership of the northern kingdom was from the house of Joseph as well.
Okay. So what you're saying is you don't think it's that unusual then that because he sort of rose up as a leader, they went, hey, this is great. You're from Yosef and you're wonderful victory. Hey, you gotta stay in charge for us because this is a good thing, right?
Yeah, and this is also the first time we actually see a will for a king. This is what's one important thing about Gideon. He's the first character that we see that actually people turn around and saying, okay, be our king. True. And this is one of the first characters where we have a really long story. And this is what I pointed out. There's very important things about Gideon. He's the first long story that we have with a lot of details. And then there's the issue, he is the first character that they turn around and say, we want to make you our king. And not only just be our leader like the judges never, it was never father to son. It was always father, was always man. His mm-hmm. sons were successful and everything, but they didn't mm-hmm. continue. Here with the story of Gideon, we actually have his son continues. This is the first box of kingship.
And it's at their suggestion, really, isn't it, in the verse that I just read out. They say, you know, you lead over us and your sons can follow.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Hey, listen, I'm going to read out Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8. It says, the officers shall speak further to the people and say, one man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted. Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart.
Yeah, so that's one of the laws of battle. There's four things you go, I think three or four things you go back home. Fearness.
If you just planted a vineyard, if you've just been married.
Go to the house, I got married. Exactly, four mm-hmm. things. And but it doesn't appear here. It's very interesting that the Bible, after the Torah, doesn't mention too many commandments. It's like as if, you know, yeah, it can be one or two things. Either going like, yeah, we know Torah, we're going to do it. But the main focus of the Bible most of the time is not necessarily focusing on the details of the Torah, but focusing on the major concept of the Torah. And that's really was the purpose of the prophets. If you look at the last chapter, the last verses in the prophets in Malachi, it says, remember the laws of Moses, my servant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he sums up the whole idea of why the prophecy is there, why there's prophecy.
Sure.
So, yeah, you look at the whole idea of the prophets. You look at the whole idea of these writings from Joshua all the way to Malachi, and really the main idea is to tell, you know, you follow the Torah, you will be successful. You will have the protection of God.
Amen.
And this is why we don't have in the prophets too many descriptions of how things were done. There's very few of them. There's in Jeremiah. There's a mentioning of Shabbat. Now, obviously, the prophets, anyone who's ever read the prophets realizes that one of the major things the prophets talk about is the issue of equality in society. Mm-hmm. So they mention things which, you know, are probably customary things which are around all the nations. You know, you look at the Torah, there's a lot of equality laws there which were probably governed, the nations around us had governed their people the same way. Mm-hmm. But you have very, very few places where it mentions commandments which are specific to the Torah. You know, you have Shabbat in Jeremiah. You have Shabbat again, and it's mentioned in the Book of Kings.
Mm-hmm.
In Ezekiel, there's very, very few places where it's actually mentioned.
And so this is, I suppose, one of the few places where there's a specific commandment that's actually implemented.
Yeah, but I'm not too sure if it's implemented here as a commandment. But we see a practice of releasing people from the army for some reason. Mm-hmm. So here the reason is different, but we see the practice itself. It wasn't as if he doesn't turn around and go like, what are you doing? No, it's probably loosely based on the idea of releasing people from military service in certain circumstances here. But here in this case, we're dealing with a completely different idea.
Specifically to thin out the numbers. And so, therefore, the proclamation in the hearing of the people saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead.
Eternal joy. Ah, Gil is beautiful. Joy. Ad is eternal. Eternal, the mountain of eternal joy.
Beautiful. Why don't we call it that in English, the mountain of eternal joy?
Well, that's it's not really a mountain. Mehar Gilad, Har Gilad here, Gilad is actually a region. So this mm-hmm. is a region of mountains. So what the Bible sometimes does, it's called a collective single. It uses a single form to express a collective. Uh-huh. So it's not really mountain of Gilad, it's the mountains of Gilad.
Beautiful. Now, I have spent some time trying to visualize what happens here in this verse. We're in verse 3. 22, obviously there's 32,000 there, 32,000 soldiers, and at this suggestion,
get up and leave.
Yeah, this suggestion, anyone who is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart, and 22,000 people go, right, all right, bye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why I said, you know, it's based on the idea of what happens in Deuteronomy, but the purpose is different.
So because
I don't think the Torah is basically saying, you know, if you're afraid, don't show up at all or run home. Because when it says fear, I understand what the point is in the Torah. The Torah is basically saying the following thing. If you're really, really, really scared to a point where you are not able to fight, you're just going to cause morale problems. Mm-hmm. And we see that, by the way, later on here. You're making a very good connection here. Look at this. Later on, we look at again at the fear factor at the enemy camp.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Exactly. So, again, we mentioned this. There's fear. There's always this issue of fear going on here. Mm. But now the fear is reversing. The fear is now mm-hmm. turning over, and the enemy becomes afraid. While he, if you look at the character of Gideon, he's becoming more powerful. He's becoming stronger and stronger in time. And he's not asking any more questions. You don't see him going like, why are you sending 2/3 of my army away?
Yeah.
He's not doing that. He's actually standing there going, okay.
He's found confidence, changed. Right? He's found
confidence, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's also interesting character development in this. It's not like, you know, you had the Barak and Devorah. He was afraid in the beginning. He said, only if you come with me, I'll go into battle. And then he just loses the glory of the battle itself because the Sisera was killed by someone else. But here, there's a character development. He starts off as being very, very afraid. He even lies about his family to try to avoid what has to be done. Mm-hmm. And now he's changing and he's becoming stronger. Mm. And now he's been told 2/3 of the army go home. Or not really go home. They're going to be standing on the mountain.
So they're gone. And then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water and I will test them for you there. And it shall be that whom I say to you, this one shall go and this will go with you and the same shall go this, that, and the other, and we'll thin them out that way. And so he says, tell them to go down to the water and all those who drink with his tongue, laps at the water with his tongue like a dog, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lap, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. Now, Yoel,
it's confusing what goes on, by the way.
I've been thinking about this. I've thought about this a lot. I don't believe I've ever seen anyone pick up a glass of water and lap it with their tongue like a dog. Have you ever seen that?
No. No, actually, I've never really seen anyone do that. Not even with their hand bringing water. Because what you do, you bring water and you pour it into your mouth. So what's this whole thing of licking it? It's very, very strange.
It is odd.
Also, the structure here of the verse is very, very strange. Because it says here in the beginning, he says to get anyone who, you know, yilok bilshono, yilok is from the word lakak, which means to lick the water like a dog. Mm-hmm. You know, have you ever seen how a dog drinks? The dog tongue is very wide, widens. So what it does is flapping the water into its mouth, mm-hmm. As it says, as the dog will lick, and you put it by themselves. And then you have the ones that go down on their knees, actually going down on their knees. So there's a that says, why down on their knees? Because the ones who were down on their knees were used to go down on their knees in front of idols. It's one of the claims that these were people who are still involved in some level of idol worshiping, so they went down on their knees to to worship. But again, it's not clear. Because I mean, it's very strange that someone just lies down on the ground to lick water. What's the deal with that? And then we have another problem. It says, and the ones who went down on the knees licking with their hand to their mouths. What is that? The whole thing is very strange. So let me first of all tell you something I've seen with my own eyes. There are cases when people are exhausted to a point that when they see water, they literally rush into the water itself. So what I think happened here, he's now picking up the weakest people in the group. And if you've ever seen this, if a person who's completely weak, completely knocked off their feet, they see water. And if I don't know if you've ever walked around the desert and stuff like that, but there are sometimes cases where people just fall to the water. They don't go even to their knees, just lie down close to the water, and they just start throwing water into their mouths.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. So maybe that's what we're dealing with.
It suddenly dawned on me at one point that this is probably what happened. The ones that were down on their knees were strong enough and were able to, you know, do the whole movement. These are like the weaklings, you know. There is the ones who are maybe the weak character or whatever it is, and they're just, you know, he picks out the weakest ones, and that's what's going on. By the way, this is not the first time this happens. This is the first time it happens, and then there's another case in the Book of Kings where they pick the most unlikely people to go out to battle.
Right. And so again, that makes sense. And I hadn't even thought of that, but that makes sense in keeping with verse 2, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying my own hand saved me. So here, potentially, he's choosing the weaker ones. Now, out of 10,000, whatever strange way it was that they were drinking, there was only 300 of them drinking. And we've gone
I think what happened here with the strange way of drinking, and what really happened here, I don't think that they put their mouths to the water and started licking. What I think is that they were using their hands as well, and the Bible was just giving us two details. I mean, there are commentators who wanted to claim, oh, the verse is corrupt, this is supposed to be somewhere else, it should be the ones who down their knees to drink, who lick with their hands to the mouth, it should be in the end of verse 6, but it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. Because I've never seen a human being put their face next to one and start looking like a dog.
No.
What I think he's saying here is that the way they approached the water, they were just down and flat on the ground with their hand in front. And when they're licking, I mean, they're so thirsty, so tired, so weak, that they're just, you know, using their tongues and everything. It looks like they're licking with their tongues. Sure. Their tongues are hanging out because they're so thirsty. That might be the answer. I'm not 100% sure, but I've seen different opinions about this, and I think this is probably the closest one to answer the question if you look at reality, what actually happens. Where I live, spend a time with a couple of hours in the desert, and they'll take you to see water. You might react that way. You never know.
So that makes sense to me. I like that. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "By these 300 men who laps, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place." So the people took provisions and their. And now I've got trumpets. They took provisions and their trumpets.
Well, it says in Hebrew, "Shofar tehem," which means. This is quite normal. What happens is in the Greek word, if I remember correctly, the Greek word for shofar and the Greek word for trumpet is the same. If you example go to the writings of Philo, I mean, you don't have to go to Philo, but Philo is a good example, because he refers to the day of Yom Tov'ah. He says the day where they bring out a trumpet. Now, Philo happens to be a Pharisee, and if he were a Pharisee, he would be using a shofar, not a trumpet. So it shows us that one of the issues is that probably the Greek word, I mean, I'm not a Greek speaker, but what I understood from this was that they said trumpet and they actually meant shofar. It was basically the idea of anything that you blow into and makes a sound in a certain way.
Mm. Okay. And so I take from this that every man had his own shofar. Is that fair?
No, I have two. I have two, and I might have a third one. I don't know.
Sure. And a couple of didgeridoos to boot. And he sent away
I have three.
All the rest of Israel, every man to his own tent, and retained those 300. Now, the camp of Midian was below him in the valley, and it happened that on the same night that Yehovah said to him, "Arise." Now, this is interesting, Yoel. I find this interesting. He says to Gideon, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand." I've got a full stop. There's a sentence. There it is. There's the commandment. Go and do it. But in verse 10, Yehovah says to him, "But if you are afraid to go down, you can go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and just listen in on the conversation, and after that your hand will be strengthened."
And it says what's going on. So it's interesting. He's still relatively afraid, But here, he's not arguing. The fear is already inside. He's not talking. He's not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
He's just acting. So we're still in the stages of development. He's not fully developed yet, the character of being a leader, but he's getting there. And what we're seeing here is very, very simple. He's just, you know, the fear is still there, and it's not gone yet.
And clearly God is aware of that. God is aware of that. He perceives his heart, and he says, hey, listen, even if you don't go down and hear what they're saying, if you were to go now, you would be victorious. But hey, if you're a little bit scared and you want to go down and check it out first, that's fine. I don't mind. You can do that. You know, he gives him permission to go and do that. I just find that interesting.
And we have, for example, another character related to the kingship. You take Yehonatan, and he's the exact opposite. He goes to the Philistine camp, and he's like, okay, just give me the sign to attack.
Yeah,
we have an idea like this again. Someone's going down to the camp to spy. Here, in this case, he's only spying. In the other case, with Yehonatan, with Jonathan, he's like,
he's out to pick a fight.
I'm going out to pick a fight. And you can see the difference in the mindset of the Israelites at this stage, where there's no leadership, there's no kingship, there's nothing, and everyone's running around like a headless chicken. So what happens the moment you have some kind of a leadership? Someone puts his foot down, and then the rest of the nation puts his foot down as well. So this is why it's pointing out there's no kingship. There's no kingship. This is what happens when there's no kingship. There's no order. There's no structure. Everyone does whatever they want. Everyone's afraid. No one's going to pick up no one's going to pick up the glove for the fight. Everyone's just running around, you know, doing their own thing. And what the message here of the Book of Judges is, put your foot down, have leadership, and we'll do fine. Don't do that. There's no Torah. There's no leadership. There's no structure. Each person does whatever they want. Okay, fear. Yes. That's what's going to happen.
And then he went down with Purah, his servants, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now, the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number.
Locusts again. Remember we spoke locusts?
And also this phrase, sand by the seashore again, in multitude, a familiar phrase when talking about a lot of people. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. How does this dream go, Yoel?
Okay, so they're saying, and he says, I saw this, it depends what the word tzalil lechem means. So a tzalil, some people explain that it's a roasted piece of bread. It's a bread that was roasted on a fire, was baked on a fire. And it's made out of seorim. Now remember that seorim grains were a very important part in the stories, because they used to go, the Amalekites, the Midianites, the Amalekites, they used to just go in and destroy all the grain.
Yep.
And why specifically seorim, I'm not 100% sure. Why seor, which is barley? But there was basically a loaf of barley bread. It was turning basically in the camp. It was attacking the camp. And he came up to a tent, and it hit the tent, and it fell over, and everything in the tent fell over as well. And so his friend, basically, we have this interesting thing, a very interesting cultural thing with dreams in the ancient world. Dreams were considered, and in many places still considered, to be a certain level of prophecy. You see something in a dream, and the interpretation can indicate what's going to happen in the future. And this is what's going on. He's telling him, I saw this gigantic loaf of bread rolling through the camp, and it's destroying everything on the way. And he basically turns around to him and says, well, really what you saw, it's actually the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, man of Israel. It's interesting, his full title. Gideon, son of Joash, man of Israel.
Yeah.
And he basically says to him, God has given the camp in his hands.
So do you reckon, when I read that, I think, I wonder how many people had similar dreams all around this vast multitude, this vast army. How many people had similar dreams, and how many people interpreted the dreams in a similar way, that God had put it in their heart to be scared of this man of God.
Exactly. And again, the fear comes into play in a moment, but the seed of fear, I mean, you have to ask yourself a very simple question. 300 men attack this massive camp and defeat them. What happened? There was divine intervention here. This is what's going on. It's telling us they knew what's going to happen. They came massive camp, but they knew what's going to happen, because the thing about it, he walks up to some tent. It doesn't matter what tent. Just walks up to one tent, and that story happens. There. You can say one or two things. He can say, oh, okay, specifically God made sure that, you know, he knew he won't go up to that tent, and that person will hear that specific dream. You know, that person will have that specific dream, and his friend will specifically interpret that way. But you can also say many people in the camp had that dream. dream, and it had no relevance to what 10 team walks up to. Each tent had at least one person have such a dream.
So this was so the general murmuring and conversation around the camp.
And I think that's probably what happened. We're having one specific telling us one specific story because we're focusing on Gideon as being the main character in the narrative, mm-hmm. but we're looking at the fact that probably a lot of people had the similar dream and fear was spread into the camp, and that was what helped them finish off the battle.
I agree. I think you're right. I agree. And so verse 15, and so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and he said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hands." And then he divided the 300 men into three companies. So I guess, 100 here, 100 there. Yeah. And he puts a trumpet into, I've got a trumpet, that would be shofar, into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. What are we talking about here when we're talking about pitchers?
No swords. Look at this, no souls. Well, they're basically, these are clay jars. By the way, just going backwards for a second, verse 15, you said he worshipped. So the word here is vaishtachu, means they bowed. So worship, probably the English translation is when they mean worship, they actually mean going, bowing down. Basically down, going down your knees and bowing your head to the ground. And right. That was one of the basic symbols of submission. And there's even manuscripts where it talks about bowing down seven times on your belly and your back, being the absolute symbol of submission.
Wow.
So probably in many cases when your text says worship, it actually means bowing. And it's not bowing like you see, for example, in a synagogue, we're talking about bowing like the Maimonides writes, where you should go down on your knees and you're flat on the face.
And so that's likely what he did when he heard this. And as you say, mm-hmm. no swords. And it's a very, I'm glad you pointed that out because of the cry that they, we'll get there in a minute, but he says, look at me and do what I do. And when I blow the trumpet and you guys do this and put them around on every side, and he said, and when I do that, you yell out Yehovah and Gideon is what it says in verse 18. And so Gideon and the three and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. What's the beginning of the middle watch?
So you divide. This is an ancient way of dividing up time. It's even done, it appears in the Talmud as well. It wasn't thing in the ancient world in general where you divide up the night into either three or four watches, which means mm-hmm. you take the time from darkness all the way to when the light starts coming up in the east. You take that time and divide up either to three or four watches. Mm-hmm. Now here specifically it doesn't mean a watch like an army watch, but it could be that this is where it originated from, that at night, I mean, who's awake at night except for people who are watchmen? Seriously, I mean, what's the point of being up all night unless you're watching over something? So this is why it's probably called a watch. But it was a system of dividing up the time at night, because at nighttime, unless you're really good in figuring out the positioning of the moon and position of the stars in the heavens, and some people are. I mean, I've met people who are astronomers, and they're able to tell you time all this based on the positioning of stars. But the whole idea is that you divide it up. I mean, for example, you take winter time, suddenly you can't see the stars. So what they did is they took the time and divided it up into sections, and you more or less how much time was from one section to the one from darkness to the beginning of light, mm-hmm. and that was considered nighttime. And then it was divided up into three or four sections, and each group of watchers would stay at that time. So you have this mentioned several, every time they mention, for example, battle at night, for example, the story with King David, where he says that he defeated the enemy all the way up to the middle watch.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea there. So and also what he's doing here.
I was just going to say, do you think it'd be about maybe a shade before midnight, as we would say?
It might be, yes. I mean, for example, if we look at the nighttime, it would be 9 hours, which is the approximate amount of time of, for example, it goes dark here at the moment here in Israel,
mm-hmm.
around sunsets around 10 to 8 in the evening, goes dark around 8:15. We don't really have mm-hmm. much twilight here in Israel. And then the sun, really light starts coming up around 5 o'clock. I mean, I've been waking up very early lately, so it's around 5, mm-hmm. 5:20. So you have about, let me see, it's 4 hours. You have about 9 hours, more or less, of nighttime.
Sure.
So you can divide it up into three sections, 3 hours, 3 hours, 3 hours. That actually, by the way, might solve the issue of why there's a dispute in the Talmud regarding three watches or four watches. It probably depends, is it summertime or wintertime? Because in wintertime, you can have darkness at My guess is sometimes at 5 o'clock in the evening, the sun doesn't rise until 6:30 in the morning next day. So that's 12, 13 hours. Mm-hmm. So they probably had 3 watches during the summer and 4 watches during the winter. So what's very important, he's about to start the attack at the beginning of the middle watch. Now, you have to think about it. If anyone's ever served in the army, what you do at watch it, what happens at watch time, specifically in the evening, you have to remember, if you're a guard and it's 12 o'clock at night, now, you've been up since sunrise, okay, which means you've been up for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. You're tired, okay? Because if you've ever done guard duty in the army, you know you don't go to bed at, say, 6 o'clock in the evening to wake up 6 hours later at 12 o'clock at night to do a watch. Mm-hmm. You might put your head down for an hour, but it goes like this. If your watch is, say, from sunset all the way to the end of the first watch, you're not going to, during the day, you won't be able to put your head down because it's going to be a lot of noise. So you stay up. So by that point, you're very, very tired. Mm-hmm. Now, someone has to go wake up the other group that does the watch. They're not up yet. Or it takes at least half an hour. If, for example, you put your head down for, say, from 8 o'clock to around 11:30, quarter to 12, mm-hmm. you put your head down. If you've been up since sunrise or even earlier than that, those 3.5 hours are actually very, you're very tired in the first hour, which means he's attacking when they're the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. They're tired, and these ones haven't really woken up yet. And I've done this dozens of times when I was in the army on both ends. So it was considered to be the worst watch. The one that we had to guard from 12 o'clock at night to 4 o'clock in the morning mm-hmm. was the worst.
Right.
Everyone hated that watch. And being experienced in this, I know what's going on here. He's attacking when they're the most vulnerable.
Sure. And I like to think, and I don't know that we know, I don't know that we know what time of the month this is happening, but I like to think that there's probably no moon.
Yeah, maybe it's really, really dark. It's a possibility. We don't really have an indicator here. The one thing we can say is that we know more or less that he's towards summertime.
Okay.
That's the one thing we can say.
And so this is what they did. They blew the trumpets. They broke the pitchers, which were in their hands. And so all of a sudden, you've got this massive trumpet blast of 100 on one side, then the other 100 blow theirs, and the other 100 blow theirs, and then all of a sudden this almighty crashing and breaking sound that's coming from all directions all at once, and then they cry out. And now what this is what I've got here, Yoel, I've got, they cried, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon."
Well, yeah, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon, yes, the Lamed here. It says Cherev La'Adonai. It's not Cherev La'Adonai, which means two, but so it's a sword to God, but it's to Gideon. The sword of God is in the work of Gideon part. This is probably what it means. So they're in the middle of the night, crashing, light suddenly appearing out of nowhere, tons of noise, people, 300 men yelling out together the same thing. And what happens? Shock.
Shock.
Literally shock.
It says every man stood in his place all around the camp. And the whole army ran and cried out and fled. And when 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companions. So what? The way I envisage this, the way I see it, is that, like you say, probably a lot of them are either asleep or they're tired. There's a few watchmen up having conversations. And, we don't know if the moon is out or not, but I like to think that it's really dark. And all of a sudden, there's not only is there the crashing noise, but, of course, they had torches inside those pitchers, right? So I suppose when they crash them on the ground, there's a big flare as well. And and it sends them into utter panic and chaos, and they run out of the tents. And the first thing in their fear that they feel to do is to defend themselves, and in the dark they're defending themselves against their companion,
and they're actually killing one of them. That's why I mentioned there were no swords. They didn't have to do anything. They just had to cause the chaos and the mayhem, and then God took care of the rest. And also we have two other cases like this. Again, Jonathan, the same thing happens. Yep. Jonathan attacks, but they're also attacking one another. So Jonathan kills like 30-odd people. And his servant, stabs them to kill, to the final kill, and here specifically, what we're having here is Gideon is doing something very similar, and we also had the same thing with Jehoshaphat, in Second Chronicles chapter 17, we have a very similar idea as well.
Sure,
they attack one another instead of them having to do anything.
And the men of Israel gathered together. Now, here in verse 23, I noticed someone's missing. Because if we go to chapter 6, verse 35, because what we have here is the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites. But in 6:35, it tells us that we also had Zebulun. So I've got a, I'm kind of thinking that maybe in the 22,000 that disappeared, and then maybe in the extra 9,700 that disappeared after that, that it seems like Zebulun's gone.
It might be that. It might really might be people of Zebulun who are the ones who went to the, now they're saying, well, we were told to go home, so they're not adding themselves to the battle.
Oh, it's quite possible. That's a good point.
It's quite possible, yeah.
And then Gideon sent messages throughout all the mountains of Ephraim saying, come down against the Midianites and seize from them the watering places as far as Beth Bara and the Jordan. And all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth Bara and the Jordan. And they captured the two princes of the Midianites, Oreb.
Oreb and Ze'ev. Oreb is crow and Ze'ev is wolf.
Crow and wolf. That's their names? Yep. Or is that that? Yep. Okay. Yeah, killed them at the wine press of Ze'ev.
Yeah, so the rock of crow and the press of Ze'ev. So these are names which were obviously given to them later on after it happened. The Bible does this all the time. It gives you a name of a place really really before the thing actually happened. So the name was given only after the story. So it was an unknown place. It was just called some rock somewhere, and they killed them there, and it became the rock of crow, the rock of Olive.
Okay,
Sul Olive.
So now in chapter 8, here we are in chapter 8. I want to read the first two verses. I want to ask you how it reads in the Hebrew in the second verse, because I find this curious. It says, now the men of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went out to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. And so he said, what have I done now in comparison with you? It is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? What does that mean?
So it says here, Halotov olelot Ephraim v'tzir Abiezer. So Halotov is a way of negative of saying, actually it is better. It's kind of funny, the Bible at one point starts using the word lo as a negation to actually express a positive. And olelot Ephraim, olelot are, for example, to le'olel, in this context, because le'olel, there's going to be the word alila as well, which means telling a story. But le'olel means to pick the last, literally the last grapes here and there, the scattered grapes on the vine. You find the word olelot a lot in the Mishnah. It talks about the issue of tithing from fruits, and or giving it to the poor. So the olelot are actually the last little bits and pieces of grapes, small, like two, three grapes here, two, three grapes over there. And the Btzira V'ezer is the actual, when they actually go and pick the grapes themselves. It says, your minor things are greater than our greatest actions. That's basically what he's saying.
Ah, okay. So he's kind of flattering them, right?
He's trying to get them off his back. He's right. Using diplomacy.
And he does. It says they were happy with him then, and they're like, okay, cool, no worries. Verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the other 300 men who were with him, they crossed over, exhausted, but still in pursuit. And then he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me. They are exhausted, and I'm pursuing. Now, who are these guys?
Zevach and Salmunah.
What does that mean?
It's probably Arab names. They're Arab equivalents. I looked it up. There's a few Arab equivalents of these names. So these were, it mentions that they were Ishmaelites. So they were probably speaking some kind of Arab dialect, and these are Arab names. So again, this is a multitude of different nations. Remember, the Midianites were in the south. So they were probably strongly exposed to Arabic as well.
Sure. And the leaders of Succoth said, now, what did they say? What goes on here? Verse 6.
They're like, no.
Really what they say is like, in a nutshell.
Like, no, 1,000 times no. They're saying, basically telling him, they don't have Zevach and Salmunah in your grasp. You're just playing around. You're not really doing anything. You're not worth anything. And he looks at them and says, what do you mean? I'm actually engaging in war here. And he says to them, you know what, because for what you just said, I am actually going to destroy your city and kill you to show you I'm actually quite capable.
Now what I've got, what I've got in verse 7, it says...
Oh, it's kind of vicious what he says. I'm avoiding saying what he actually said he's going to do.
It is.
But he basically says he'll take the thorns of the desert and literally comb their flesh with it.
I've got here in the English, it says, I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Ouch. Mm-hmm. And so anyway,
ouch is a good description, yeah.
Yeah, and so then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And he said to those guys, hey, look, and they answered him in the same way as those from Sukkot. So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, when I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower. So there's a couple of threats that he's got to come good
on. And do the exact same thing to them as well.
Mm. And for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen, 120,000.
Yeah. That's a chaos.
Against each other. How about that? And then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwelt in tents, and they fled. He pursued them. He took the two kings of Midian and routed the whole army. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Heres, and he caught a young man from Sukkot and interrogated him, and he wrote down. Now, I've got to ask you, what he wrote down. What did he write on? What was he writing? What kind of alphabet are we talking?
Oh, what kind of alphabet? Wow.
Because we're talking about 77 names here that he's written down, apparently.
Yeah, he gave him 77 names. You're asking a very, very difficult question here. Because I can say one thing, and then people say I'm wrong, and they can say another thing, and then other people say I'm wrong. The alphabet used at this period is actually... I don't really think we have alphabet from this period of time. The main theory that most people go by is that this was a form of Paleo-Hebrew, some kind of early stage maybe of the Paleo-Hebrew that we know of, for example, from inscriptions and things like that. The question is, what exactly Paleo-Hebrew looked like? Now, there's a classic thing when it comes to the issue of pictographs, for example. The Egyptians used them as hieroglyphs. But in this region, they were actually using one of two systems. They were either using Paleo-Hebrew, and when I say Paleo-Hebrew, I mean actual real Paleo-Hebrew. I'm not referring to the pictographs, which are promoted the past couple of years, because there are not enough examples of those. The pictographs that I've heard of from a lot of people, there's only like two or three examples of it, and it's not been 100% deciphered. And some of the stuff that's been said about it is guesswork. I actually sat down to look through. There's like two pieces of pottery or something. I have that, or one piece of pottery was found in some cave somewhere as well. We don't 100% know enough about it. It's not clear. I get asked about this by students because when I do a lesson, I give an introduction to alphabet as well. And I actually taught myself Paleo-Hebrew when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I actually can read and write Paleo-Hebrew. It's not very difficult to do, by the way. And if you know Hebrew, it's just memorizing symbols. That's all it is. It's pretty simple.
Sure.
But the alphabet that's well known is what's called Paleo-Hebrew, which is an alphabetic system, and it doesn't the shapes don't have meaning. It's just a shape that represents a consonant. The other system they had here was probably a cuneiform or cuneiform, depends who's pronouncing the word, which was actually a sound system. They actually had each symbol represented a sound, and you build up a word by putting certain sounds together, combining certain sounds together, and the word comes out. So that was a very, very complex system, which was actually dropped the moment the people in this region discovered the concept of an alphabetic system. Because what you can do with an alphabetic system is write almost any language. If you have a phonetic alphabetic system, you can literally write any language, no matter what that language is. This is transliterations. You know, for example, in English, it's a bit more difficult. A lot of workbooks, for example, try to tell you, okay, do a transliteration of certain words. What they've actually done is a lot of the people who do transliterations, they take symbols from different languages, each one of them expressing a certain sound in Hebrew, and then you learn how to write those out. But what they've done, which is even more interesting, is actually a system, an international system of a phonetic language where it has very specific symbols, and you can write that out, and it's very fast to write. You can literally write an entire lecture. And there was a time where official things, for example, in the UN, they actually had people who sat there and wrote in this phonetic alphabet, and they could give it to anyone in the UN, anyone who's an official, no, people or anyone there, but anyone who was involved in passing on the information to the officials, mm-hmm. actually had guys who were trained to read this alphabet. So no matter what happens, everyone's reading the same alphabet.
Right.
So it could be one of several things. It could be that they were using cuneiform here. It could be that they were using Paleo Hebrew. It could be that they were using something else. Remember, you have to remember these are northern tribes, so they might have been using something which related to Aramaic. The chances are this was either cuneiform or Paleo Hebrew.
Brilliant.
The pictographs probably not, but we can't say 100% because we don't have too many examples from that period of time.
Sure. But in any case, he writes down 70. This guy that they catch, right? Gideon interrogates him. He writes down 77 names of the elders of Sukkot. What does he do with those names? Verse 15.
He goes in and kills them. He finds them and kills them.
He says, "Remember me?" Yeah.
Yeah. Remember me? You spoke with me. You know, you were actually talking not nice to me.
Here are the kings. Here are the kings I were pursuing.
Yeah, and yeah, here they are. Remember, now we're closing the. So remember, this is a character of a king. This is what Sundance kings did. You know, you talk incorrectly to me, I punish you. You misbehave towards me, I punish. And we have this with other kings as well. Even kings of Judea did the same thing.
So in verse 16, in the English, I've got, and he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Sukkot. He taught them?
Yeah, well, he says Vayodaot. I mean, he got them to know each other very well.
Right. Okay. Then he tore down the tower
up close and personal. That's what he did. It's interesting. He uses the word to know. Vayodaot Bahemata. It's interesting. He uses that specific word.
Yeah, that brings up other images. Let's not go there. And then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. And he said to the kings, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?"
Ooh, this is a very important verse. This verse developed a theory that the real reason that Gideon went out to war, one of the reasons he was chosen, is because he had a personal vendetta with these people. They murdered him, members of his family. So he was chosen also for the issue of revenge. So if we go back to the issue of the Goel Dam, the person who goes, the family savior who goes and takes the personal revenge for death of members of family.
Yes.
Some people claim this must be one of the reasons why it happened.
Right. So the kings answered and they said, "As you are, so were they. And each one resembled the son of a king." There we go. There's a reference to king again.
So, yeah, but what he's saying basically, you look like them. These were relatives.
Right. And Gideon said to the kings, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As Jehovah lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you." And he said to Yeter, his
so there's a lot of interesting names here. There's a lot of interesting Yeter can be related to the name Yitro, maybe. It can be related to the word Yitra. It can be different. It might be a shortened version of one of these names.
Right. Okay. Well, so he gives the job to his firstborn, right?
Yeah, he says, like, you're the firstborn, you take care of them. And his son is just too afraid to do anything. He's still young.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this, I think it makes you wonder how old Gideon himself actually was. And yes. if you know the Middle East well, a lot of people in the Middle East, we become grown-ups very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember in the ancient world, you know, by the age of 15, many people were married.
Mm-hmm.
People worked. It wasn't as if you go to college and afterwards. No, you reach an age, you start getting involved in the family trade or you start traveling or whatever it is. So think about Gideon. I mean, his son, it says his son is still a Nar, which means he's still a young boy. So his son might be older than 15. Gideon might be 30 years old, 32. He's young.
He might be in his late 20s. Yeah, he might be 30. Yeah, no, you're right.
He might be in his late 20s, early 30s. He's young.
And so his son was too afraid because he was still in his youth. So so the king said, "Rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength." What does that mean?
Well, it says, "Ufgabanu ki chayish ke gevurato." As a man is his might is not strength. Might. Gevura won't necessarily mean strength. It can also mean someone's might, someone's ability to act. So he's basically saying, we're kings And you're telling your son to kill us? It's some kind of level of sarcasm going on here. Sure. You're basically saying, no, give us an honorable death that you kill us.
Give us a death worthy of kings, right?
Now, the other side of it also is that if a young man lifts a sword to kill or lifts a spear to thrust into their hearts or something, whatever it would be, because he's weaker, the death is slower. Here, if it's a sword, he just goes cut something off or cut their neck, whatever it is, he's less afraid and he's stronger, which means the death is faster.
Fair enough.
So they're basically saying, we're mighty kings, we're strong people, and we want to be killed by you, not by some boy, and most definitely not by someone who's actually physically weak. Right. Basically asking for an honorable and quick death.
Yeah,
no, they're basically asking for one simple thing. They're saying, give us an honorable and quick death.
Makes sense. And so he does, and he takes the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. The crescent ornaments, that appears somewhere else. I did a little bit of digging around.
Yeah, there's a few other places mentioned, yeah.
In Isaiah chapter 3, Isaiah chapter 3, verse 18.
It gives a very long list of jewelry. Mm. And one of the classic jewelries, types of jewelry here in this area, a little pieces of gold or silver, mm-hmm. Either circles or little crescents, stars, things like that. So I've actually, I've seen camels from years ago. I think they stopped doing this, but race camels in the Arabian Peninsula, ones which are very good, they usually have ornaments on them and sometimes even gold pieces. And I've seen, very rarely, but I've seen places where they actually had these ornaments which were moon-shaped or crescent-shaped.
Okay.
So this also gives you, I'll say something very interesting about them. They're Ishmaelites, which means they're from the south. There's one of the classic symbols is a crescent moon. So this might be also a religious symbol. It's not just a crescent. It's actually a religious symbol as well. Might have been forgotten by us at one point, but for example, if we take Islam, their symbol is a crescent.
Of course, yeah.
So again, the symbols, I think we spoke about this a while back, about the issue of the relationship between the pagan religions of the Arabians and Islam.
Mm.
And symbols, it was done all the time. A lot of religions did this. They just took the old symbols, put them in the new religion, and just kept things familiar. And
continued on, right. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so that's interesting. But then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your sons and your grandsons also. So it's like, hey, you can be our royal family. You can just sort of carry on.
Exactly.
You're a good thing. For you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my sons rule over you. Yehovah shall rule over you. Then Gideon said to them, but I'd like to make a request, if that's all right. Each of you give me the earrings from his plunder. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So that's characteristic of the Ishmaelites to have gold earrings, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Not today, but yeah.
But apparently back in the day. So they answered, and they said, we'll gladly give you the gold earrings. And they spread out a garment, and each one man threw in the earrings from his plunder. And now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold beside the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes.
Your one actually says shekel.
I've got shekels. That's in italics, so it's not there.
Yeah, no, it says here 1,700 gold. So when it uses the word gold or silver, mm-hmm. it's actually in a way called a shekel. If it's referring to bars of gold, because it was also not necessarily bars, but there's a thing called a shekel and a thing called a kikar. And the kikar, the word kikar means a bar of gold or silver. But again, we have to remember that these are weights. These are not just, there was, like, for example, you go to Fort Knox, if you get in there, each bar of gold, essentially, if there is any gold in Fort Knox, I've heard actually people claim there's no gold there anymore. Sure. But if you take that, each one of them has a specific weight. So the shekel is a specific weight. There's several opinions how heavy it was. And there's a thing called a bar, or kikar, which is a certain weight. I think a kikar, I can't remember exactly the numbers, but each certain amount is something else. And this is really referring to a weight, not to a certain size or actual coins and stuff like that. Sure. As you remember, I remember years ago I had an argument. This actually developed an argument with a guy in Yeshiva where he was going like, oh, shekel, it was actual coin. I'm like, no, it's a weight. And I'd known this fact for years already. It was a weight, There were never coins discovered until the Persian period. There were really the coinage, the concept of coins comes from Persia. Hmm. And before that, it was just pieces of metal. And all the treasures.
It was Darius, I think, that implemented an international currency out of coins, mm-hmm. out of gold coins.
That's exactly what the Persians were the first real sophisticated bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So now, what does he do with all this gold? I mean, it's a hell of a lot of gold. What does he do with it?
Well, he gives some of it to me, and I'll be happy. No, I'm kidding. What he does, he actually makes a thing called an ephod. Now, what exactly is the nature of this thing called this ephod? And we find the word ephod for example, used as part of priestly garments. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really clear what does it mean, ephod, here. He might have made some kind of... some kind of plate of metal or something with something written on it. It might be something with a specific shape. It is not clear because it's just ephod. I know the word ephod mostly used in the Bible for as a priestly vestment. Mm. And we find the only other place I remember that you can actually find this concept of making ephod from metal is later on in the book of Judges. Someone else makes an ephod. But an ephod, essentially the idea of the word ephod here is actually basically a religious item. What exactly is the nature of this religious item? It's not very clear, at least not to me.
No, it's you're right. It's not clear, but it is interesting because it reminds me of Judges chapter 17. Now, of course, we're going to get here eventually, but I've got to read verse 5.
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, and it says, this is verse 5. Now, this is a silver one, but nonetheless, it says, the man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household mm-hmm. idols. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. And those of you who are familiar with that story, it didn't go well. And here it doesn't go well either.
Here it doesn't go. But the question, why does he do this? So one of the ideas that I came up with, I don't think it's an original idea, but I may have probably read it somewhere, is that his point was to do it a symbol of the victory. It wasn't for being a religious item. It was being a symbol of like, we won, and this is some kind of commemoration.
Monuments,
like
right?
A monument, exactly. The Romans were very big on that, and other nations were very big on that. But we don't have that. It's very interesting. We don't find monuments like that to any battles of the Israelite kings. Kings all over the world boasted, we did this, we did that. You know, there's a monument from one of the Egyptian kings where he talks about, he mentions Israel. Israel is no more. Like, what are you talking about? And that was one of the, yeah, but that's what they did. You know, we defeated this, we did that. Mm-hmm. For example, Sanherib writes about King Hezekiah, I caged him like a bird in a prison, and stuff like that. And they boasted and make a lot of noise. And it was very interesting. The kings of Israel weren't even like that. You know, you have the verse in Isaiah says, "You have forfeited the quiet waters of the Shiloh, and you're glorifying Ratzin and the son of Remaliahu." So that's one of the major differences. So it's very interesting. His point here was probably to commemorate, mm-hmm. and that developed into idol worshiping. And mm-hmm. the other idol that we have that survives is. It's kind of he puts it in his in Ophran. It literally becomes an idol, and they follow it because they saw it as being the symbol of their victory. The only other idol we have similar to this is we have Micha, and then we have the copper snake. The copper snake actually is very interesting. Copper snake mm-hmm. survives all the way to the time of King Hezekiah.
Hundreds of
years after it was actually made.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting the mentality was going on with the Israelites when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so in the English it says here, and all Israel played the harlot with it there in Ophrah, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Thus the Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then, and now here we are again. Look, verse 29, here is his other name, Jerubbaal, or Yerubbaal.
Yerubbaal, son of Joash. So he goes and sits in his house. He basically means, okay, I'm done. I'm going to retire.
I'm going to chill. I've retired. I've got my gold, and I got all that stuff. And that's it. Now, we're gonna pull the brakes on there because the next, it kind of kicks off from verse 30 that we find out Gideon had a whole lot of sons. One of them was Avimelech. And I find that before we clock off on this one, Yoel, can you tell us a little bit about the name Avimelech? What does it mean?
So it's interesting. Avimelech. My father is king.
My father is king. So he named his son, my father is king. What does that say about the situation? What does that say about his retirement?
He was kind of like half living as king, probably. So Avimelech, it depends how you accent it. It can be Avimelech or Avimelech. I mean, my son, my father is king, or father of the king. But still, you see this king thing coming up, and it kind of gives you an indication of Avimelech wasn't a shmo. His family, they weren't no ones. They actually became even more important than what they were in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an element here of wanting to be king, but realizing that it could be that one of his decisions was a political decision where he kind of goes like, this nation is a mess. I don't want to be involved.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Perhaps. That might be part of it. It's really, you know, clear, but yes, you're pointing out a very important thing. Avimelech. So,
another thing that's interesting before we go is that, because I just noticed that in all the these chapters on Gideon, nowhere does it actually...
Wait. Gideon. You keep on so saying Gideon, something like that.
Gideon. Gideon.
Break just it up Gideon? Into two syllables.
Two syllables. Gideon.
Gideon, okay. Exactly.
But Gideon.
Incorrect. Gideon.
Well, in all the chapters on Gideon, nowhere does it refer to him as being a judge. It's kind of like Shamgar. Shamgar, of course, Shamgar it doesn't say Shamgar.
Anat. Yeah, Shamgar ben Anat.
Okay, so, but in any case, there's a slight a suggestion of some kind of kingship, at least recognized in his local area. There we go. There's the story of Gideon.
Yeah, we actually were able to squeeze everything in.
We did it. And we're going to be kicking off from chapter 8, verse 30. We're going to be talking about Avimelech next week. Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend, thank you for coming back onto Truth to You. Just a reminder, everybody, there is a waiting list, but you can get on it. It is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the land. The Levite in the desert, as it is now.
No, I'm still in the land. It's still land.
In the desert of the land. And you can get on the Facebook page as well, Hebrew in Israel. And so join us next week. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed to be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.